I'll open the Subcommittee on Natural Resources for the Joint Ways and Means Committee of February 9th, 2015. We have one item on the agenda this morning, a public hearing on SB 5512, the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, commonly known as DGAMI. Do we have, I'll go to Mr. Terpening first.
Thank you, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. Just want to walk you real quick through what you can expect to find on OLIS under today's meeting materials. There will be a copy of the agenda, the DGAMI budget presentation, the Chief Financial Office presentation, and there will also be what in here we're calling the co-chair budget framework document, but we got a new naming convention. So you'll see what that is an LFO template that you'll see for each agency. Obviously, this is the first of many agency hearings you'll have in the next couple of weeks. That document that LFO produces basically is an overview. It provides some basic policy issues, other significant issues that you might find, and then it has a little section on the co-chair's budget framework discussion. Just to recap that a little bit, while there wasn't specific detail as far as the agency budget numbers, the co-chairs did express their intent to provide the agency with a standard two-year budget and also to provide some additional general fund limitation to support the backfill and revenue shortfalls. Additionally, the co-chairs noted that the continued funding of LIDAR mapping is an additional issue that needs to still be addressed. With that, Vicki McConnell, the Executive Director for the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, can begin.
Okay. Ms. McConnell, if you'd please come forward and identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Co-Chair Devlin and Co-Chair Rayfield and committee members. For the record, my name is Vicki McConnell, and I'm the Executive Director for the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries and also the State Geologist for Oregon. And I really appreciate this opportunity to present our biennial budget for the biennium of 15-17 and appreciate your interest and questions and anything that we can do to help you as we go through this. I have with me a whole variety of things to keep me from going into a coughing fit. So if I go in that direction, I'm apologizing ahead of time. It's been a rough week with one of these cruds that are going around. I also would like to introduce right now some of my executive team that's with me today. I have Andre Pollock, who is the Assistant Director for the Geologic Survey and Services Program. That's our science and technology program. And I have Ian Maiden, who is our presently our Chief Scientist, but at the end of the month will become the Interim Director for DGAMI as I am stepping down the end of February. And also, the chair of our governing board, Umatilla County Commissioner Larry Givens, is also here today.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So with that, I will go ahead and go into the presentation. As we said, this is the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. What I'm going to do today is go through who we are, what we do, why we do it, who we serve. Talk a little bit about our metrics and investments in the agency, but also talk a bit about some of the challenges, particularly on our budgetary structure and financial stability for the agency that I think is important for us to have a discussion about. So we're going to start with about DGAMI, which, as Chair Devlin said, that's what our nickname is, so we'll go with that. We've been around since 1937 in the form that we are now, and initially the agency was developed as a rural economic engine developer for post-depression area, for the rural areas. And it was really to be one of the three primary natural resource economic drivers for rural Oregon, and that would have been forestry, agriculture, and mining. So we were primarily, and at that time only, out there. We had at that time, our mission was go forth, do resource assessments on minerals and energy minerals, publish geologic maps, and develop interest and actually help prospectors. We even offered grub stakes at that time, and we had a free assay lab, and that was paid for by the state as an investment for rural economic development. Well, things have changed a bit in the ensuing years, and our mission, while we still have resource assessments as part of our mission and goals, we are a little broader now. We have evolved so that the geosciences really address a whole variety of issues, both rural and urban, and both social policy and scientific. We focus ourselves around our mission, which is to provide earth science information and regulation to make Oregon safe and prosperous. This is taken directly from our newly adopted 2015 to 2021 strategic framework. We redo our framework every 6 years, or our plan, our strategic plan every 6 years. This one was just adopted by our governing board the beginning of January, and will be our focus over the next 6 years on what are those goals and objectives that not just us internally, but this was with input from external, from stakeholders. We spent a year vetting this strategic framework. So it does identify those goals and objectives that we're working toward, and it also is develops reflective of the governor's 10-year plan and initiatives, primarily around disaster resilience, clean waters and working landscapes, effective governance, and effective and streamlined regulation of the mining and mineral industries. Those goals are around earth science, which require and organize complete descriptions of Oregon's geologies, landforms, and geoprocesses, natural hazards, which create and compile comprehensive assessments of natural hazards and community vulnerability, resource management to administer effective and balanced regulation of mineral, oil and gas, and geothermal energy development in the state, governance and operations, provide leadership, develop partnerships, and maintain professional standards to optimize our mission, and outreach and education to provide earth science, resource management, and natural hazards information to support decisions and solutions from an individual to a leadership and policy level. Who do we serve? Well, we initially serve everyone in the state at some level, from the lay public who are interested in our information, again, about resources or hazards and environmental protection. We have a wide variety of partners, from federal agencies and entities through the nonprofits, academia, many of our sister state agencies. We also do cooperative partnerships and projects with. So we reach out. We really are partner oriented. We also serve the mining industry, as we are their regulatory overseer, to make sure that they are operating in such a way that they minimize offsite impact and that they can reclaim at a level that will be sufficient to satisfy their secondary beneficial use of their land. And, of course, we serve leadership of the state, both the governor's office and the legislature. We're organized broadly into two broad programs, the Geologic Survey and Services Program. That's our science and technology. When you think of mapping and geology and all of that, that is pretty much what's in that program. That maps to the governor's 10-year strategy under safety for mitigation of hazards, jobs and innovation for identifying resources and economic development, and healthy environment, as we develop earth science information and data that can be used toward healthy environments. And then our regulatory program is the Mineral Land Regulation and Reclamation Program. Reclamation to protect environment and enhance the economy, healthy environment, and jobs and innovation are primarily where that is mapped to. Now, if you look at it on a map, an org chart, what you see here is We have the governor, we have a five-person governing board, the state geologist, two programs that are overseen by assistant directors. This is the survey and services here, which also includes the physical office that serves the entire agency, and then our what we call MLRR, our Mine Land Regulation and Reclamation, which is actually four regulatory programs, as we said, surface mining, chemical process mining, oil and gas, and geothermal exploration and development. And then in this in the survey and services program, this is broadly put together on geographic. We have we still have a couple of our geographic field offices, and then toward specialties such as geohazards and mapping and minerals research. And we generally always have policy option package that asks for additional limitation for and authority to hire limited duration FTEs that are project specific depending on the projects that we're working on at the time. We have a net positions of 50 total FTE in our budget, the existing budget of 49. We also have span of control of right now 1 to 34 in pro and in our GS&S and 1 to 10 in our MLRR. This is a little much span of control. We do have a project ops manager that is other funded and federally funded, and we when we have the indirect or the projects, we hire that one. When we don't, then we have to keep that that particular management level vacant, and it is vacant at the present. Now, this does say the 15, the 13-15, but this is actually in our governor's recommended budget. Very similar. We're not coming in with any kind of reorganization. We'll have a slightly fewer net total positions. The FTE here reflects the fact that we have a one-year budget in the in what's in the GRB, and we are asking for authority for several limited duration FTE. Again, here. Span of control is the same. I put the divided by two here because we will be looking at trying to get a project ops manager if our budget will allow that for the next next biennium. Our actual business model is really more project and enterprise oriented. We provide products to users on a project basis. We like to think that our products sell themselves. That works very well for projects and competitive grants. We have a lot of support, and you will have seen a lot of support letters that were sent to you that should be in your packet. I'm going to be pointing out some of the challenges or flaws to our more enterprise business model right now. And first, one of those is when you're responding to, and that's really what we are, is responding to issues that are brought forward by local government, our federal partners, et cetera, there's no way for the state to really weigh in on prioritized statewide issues, and there's certainly no way for us to develop comprehensive programs to look broadly across the landscape and get the same information fairly to everyone that may be affected. We go by team operations, so even though we had all of those difference, the Eastern Oregon field office, the geohazards office, et cetera, even though we have that identified in the budget, we really work as teams. We take specialists from all those sections and assign as needed to products based on their subject matter expertise and what we're attempting to produce from those. That allows for a lot of cross-pollination of staff, increases opportunities to serve the public. And that's why we generally are asking for authorization for limited duration professional staff so that we can strategically hire folks what we need for project oriented. The issue comes when we are in between projects because the projects are not that we have to compete for them or they have to come to us. They're not, we don't know if we'll automatically get them. That puts our subject matter experts in peril. Sometimes we don't have a project to put them on. We have to then backfill that with general or other funds. Or we would have to let them go, which would be a real mistake on trying to hire the kind of high-level technical staff that we use. Outreach is critical. If we're not out there producing information and getting the information out, and also helping people to understand how they can use it, whether it's a city using our land use inventory maps for their local land use planning ordinances, those kind of conversations, then we're not really achieving what we want to, which is our information to be used for crucial decision making. So that requires considerable front and back end non-recoverable investment, because those kind of investments generally are not able to be wrapped into projects or grants. We do look at everything we do under a lens of continuous improvement. And I'm not going to go through this line by line, but we're always looking at where we can improve our LIDAR funding. We're always looking at what federal cooperative programs are available. We try to identify where the emerging issues are. We link most of that then to our key performance measures and our outcomes and metrics, and I'll talk about that here in a minute. In the MLRR, the Mineral Land Regulation and Reclamation Program, again, we've seen a big uptick in geothermal and renewable energy and a little bit of interest in gas exploration. So that becomes an issue where we need to be keep ahead of that. We also are still in the midst of a metal mining exploration and notice of intent for operating permit for a chemical process gold mine in Malheur County. As I said, we link all of this to our performance metrics and the governor's 10-year plan. And if you look on the left, it identifies where our policy option packages are, which are our asks for additional staff and investment for specific projects or programs we have. And then on the right, it identifies where our key performance measures are linked so that they can measure our outcomes for these particular programs. And I'll be going into that in a little bit more detail. For MLRR, that's the same. We have key 10-year plans, and then we work around what's identified in our strategic framework. So for key performance measures, which we bring before the Ways and Means Committee to review and eventually approve, what I'm going to do now is I usually use the key performance measures to review our progress on our key performance measures, discuss where investments in these policy option packages would help to improve both our outcomes and our metrics, and also identify where we have opportunities, challenges, and bring forward where we suggest some changes. The way that we put our key performance measures together is Oregon is a big state. It has a lot of really dynamic geology. The geology is a driver for almost all natural resource and issues in the state. From it is directly linked with both our marine, oceanic, and atmospheric. The geology determines why we have a wet west side of the state and a dry east side of the state. It's very active. It's both a resource and can be a threat, so it keeps us very busy. We could not possibly be working everywhere in the state all at the same time. Too big for that, too many issues. So what we've done is use a proxy of focusing most of our effort on where the people and the intersection between where you have the natural landscape and individuals, be it infrastructure, be it where they're doing most of their industry, or be it where people live. And so what we've used is water well density as a proxy for population areas. And so what you see here is a map that shows where the most water well density is, and you'll see it nicely tracks as to where we have most of our population, most of our infrastructure, and a lot of the urban areas. So that's also what we use as a focus for our LIDAR data collection program. And that's the second thing that we use for determining where we're going to focus projects. And that is, do we have the high-resolution LIDAR data that we collect for the state available for those areas? I'm going to give you a really quick primer on LIDAR. I think I've probably bugged everybody in here I don't know how many times on what LIDAR actually is, but it's light ranging. It uses laser scanners mounted on an aircraft to collect hundreds of millions of precise measurements of the landscape, creating what we call a point cloud. And that point cloud looks like this. And I chose the capital here so that you would know exactly where you are in space and time right now. And so those laser pulses can be measured. They'll determine very precisely what the elevation is anywhere that this point cloud is collected. And so it collects infrastructure, it collects the canopy, and it can be modeled so it actually collects what we call the bare earth, or what is if you strip everything off, what does the lay of the land look like? It's digital, therefore it's interrogatable. It's not just a snapshot. You can use that to answer questions, to query, to develop other models. It can show canopy heights, and it also shows surface models. So what is it used for? Well, just about anything that uses or looks at the landscape or what's sitting on the landscape can use digital elevation information. Forest management, natural hazard science, ecosystems and watersheds, managing streams, watersheds, and habitat, infrastructure management and planning, including urban mapping the urban landscape, inventorying structures and vegetation, change detection, engineering design, hazard monitoring, and agricultural applications. So we, as geologists and geoscientists, love LIDAR because it's made our mapping and our modeling incredibly precise and accurate over the last 10 years. But we're not the only ones that use it. And our LIDAR data collection program is really a service to the state and to all the agencies, including academia and the lay public, who love our LIDAR maps for hiking and mapping. The business model we use for the LIDAR is, again, a partnership model. We have what's called the Oregon LIDAR Consortium. We build partnerships around shared areas of interest, pool funds used to make large projects using a statewide price agreement that we're responsible for. We've been very successful in attracting partners through the last 7 years. We've had a total $2 million direct investment from the state, of which we have now leveraged that to $19 million with 67 partners. And that's everything state, federal, tribal, regional, corporations, watershed councils, etc. If you look at where we have successfully collected LIDAR, you'll see that it nicely overlaps with many of the areas that we have identified as the priority areas. This gives you just quickly what the LIDAR looks like by biennium. We have to focus on this on areas of interest. Again, this is as comprehensive a program as we can have with a minimal amount, and we have had no state investment in the last 4 years. This is right here, just bring your attention. Here's where the focus is for the next biennium. And I'll explain why that is in a moment here. But again, that's a 1-9. Return on your investment, nearly $19 million invested by partners. Many of those partners and the largest investors have been the land management, federal agencies, and the U.S. Geological Survey. So the federal partners have really stepped up and put money forward and been a great partner with the state, particularly the Forest Service and BLM. We do have a policy option package, our LIDAR data acquisition program. We're asking for $1 million to be invested into the LIDAR data acquisition. This identifies where the priorities are in the state for what's the OGIC, which is the Oregon Geographic Information Council approved state plan. It's also the governor's Clean Water Partnership priorities. And it's also part of a U.S. Geological Survey 3DEP program, which we have been informed we have been awarded $770,000 toward next year. But we do have to have a match for that. And those priority areas are all similar. So what I'm going to do now is quickly go through our key performance measure structure and talk about the key performance measures, the programs that those satisfy, how we're doing, where we're suggesting some changes, and where the challenges are. And I don't go through them 1 through 12. We have 12 of them. We actually do it reporting from the most foundational work we do, which are detailed geologic maps, and then building up through the what we call the derivative of information, our hazard maps and our regulatory maps. So we have several for the survey and services. We have 2 for the mineral land regulation and reclamation. We do have agency-wide key performance measures as well. So we'll start with detailed geologic mapping. Again, you'll see that base of where we focus our priorities. The red shows where we've actually achieved detailed mapping. We're about 56% complete. We make steady but slight increases every year. Most of this mapping is based on competing for funds from the U.S. Geological Survey. We have an advisory group that advises us on where we should be prioritizing our work or focusing. We're just finishing up the South Coast down here, and we'll be starting to work in the Mid-Columbia Basin this next year. That's also in cooperation with some mapping we're doing for the Oregon Water Resources Department as they're looking at implementing their integrated water resources plan. We start with digital models. We turn those into maps. It's a lot of people on the field doing a lot of basic mapping. From there, we roll those up into regional geologic maps. We're about 96% complete right now on completing regional maps for the state. We put a focus in front of ourselves a few years ago to compile and digitize and turn into a digital geologic model all of the best mapping available at that time. Took us 6 years to complete that project, compiled 70 years worth of work, hundreds of maps into an online digital map, into a digital model that we're trying to get up online. This is very near complete. We would like to revise our KPM to measure how the mapping and data are made available to the public, and we'd like to work with the legislature on how we would design that. I would also note that we need investment in this particular work to be able to update these digital models to incorporate newer data, because right now everything we have is a snapshot as to when we completed that comprehensive, but anything new that's coming into the system, we simply don't have the capability right now to keep that updated. And also we need investment to develop a searchable web-friendly map that we can keep online and keep updated. We have tried to put that together with Band-Aids. We cooperated with Portland State University for several years for them to host the map, but we needed to bring that in-house, and we just don't have the investment to keep that up. This is an example of a derivative map from the regional information. This is from the Oregon Resilience Plan as we put together the earthquake scenario for the Cascade Subduction Zone earthquake. This is peak ground acceleration, which essentially gives you what is the hazard for an earthquake geographically located. And that's taken directly from the basic rocks and soils that you get from your regional maps. Now we'll start looking at some of our hazard mapping. We have earthquake and landslide. Our KPM1 is actually a combo earthquake and landslide map completion. And certainly one of the things that we would like to bring forward is these two measurements are not tracking and they're not always the same, and we would like to split this into two key performance measures and have one for seismic earthquake hazards and that program, and then another for our landslide hazards program. Right now, if you look, this shows where we have LIDAR landslide map areas where we've done some work. Some of it's more regional than the other. We consider this about 23% complete. Again, having the LIDAR data makes all the difference in the world of being able to identify where we've had landslides in the past and what those deposits are like. That helps us to understand where the most likely area and high vulnerability and susceptibility are, because where they were in the past means you're more likely to have them, not guaranteed, but more likely to have them in the future. An example of this is looking at Oregon City. This is an aerial photograph of Oregon City. You see there's areas in here. If you look at this, it looks pretty... you don't see much but the trees and the buildings, and you really would have a hard time to interpret what the landform looks like. If you look at it as a LIDAR product, it's very easy to pull out where all the landslides are and which ones are even active now. And so, again, the correlation, this is, we liken it to being able to put your glasses on and actually be able to focus and see what the lay of the land is. It's really been crucial to our successful work within hazards. We do have a policy option package to bring forward for landslide hazard mitigation program. This also fits with the governor's Clean Water Partnership Initiative. Landslides and debris flows have quite an effect on the turbidity and the channels for watersheds and for streams and watersheds. So there's an interest of understanding where you're both not the urban but also the rural areas are that are susceptible to landslides. We'd like to transform our landslide hazard projects into comprehensive statewide program that would have priorities set by the state through stakeholder advisory committees, and we could then start focusing on producing our landslide hazard maps in a comprehensive and thoughtful manner as we have a campaign across the state. And as I said, we'd like to separate this key performance measure into two. Now, on the earthquake side, we have actually exceeded our target to produce statewide hazard maps, and that's what you're seeing here is for 3D hazard maps, three-dimensional hazard maps. We have very focused areas where we've been able to actually go in, and by three-dimensional means we've looked both at the subsurface and the surface and been able to make interpretations. We have been able to look at the surface and develop statewide 2D hazard maps, so that is complete and is being used by the state in some of our framework information. We do have a policy option package to bring forward on that, because we'd like to refocus our seismic program to begin doing more probabilistic assessments as per our strategic framework and also the Oregon Resilience Plan. And as I said, we would like to revise it again. Let me talk a little more detail about the... this particular policy option package. It has two parts to it. One of it, as I said, in line it with the Oregon Resilience Plan and our strategic framework. And I think most folks know and understand we have seismic hazards in this state. And it's not just from the Cascade Subduction Zone seismic hazard, but it's also we are the proud owners of all four types of earthquakes: crustal, deep, volcanic, and subduction zone. So the focus on being able to understand and interpret all of those and develop these probabilistic hazard maps and vulnerability studies are really key. So the first part of that would be general fund investment into seismic hazard mitigation. There is also a one-time funding investment in our governor's recommended budget to purchase National Science Foundation seismic instruments. It's a seismic array of 15 instruments that are presently located in the state and are part of a large academic research study. However, it would make perfect sense, and the National Science Foundation would be happy to sell them to the state, and we could then incorporate them into the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network so that it would enhance our ongoing seismic ability to track and have a seismic regional seismic network. It also will potentially be part of the earthquake early warning system that eventually will be a federal program here in the state. We pull tsunami hazards out separately from our seismic hazard program because even though they are geographically limited, it is one of the most catastrophic of hazards that we have for seismic hazards. I'm not going to belabor the event. I know folks have tracked this over the last 10 years, starting with Sumatra 10 years ago, Chile, and then Japan now going on 4 years ago. We are in an area that has these types of catastrophic hazards, and we have exactly the same type of geology off our state that would, and we know from tremendous amount of excellent work by academia and our own scientists that we have had reoccurring cascade subduction zone earthquakes over the last 10,000 years. So the question is, how do we prepare for that in a thoughtful and careful way? The first thing that we did was put in front of us several years ago, and we are the administrators of the National Tsunami Hazard Mitigation Program for the state in cooperation with the Office of Emergency Management. We said we need to understand what the inundation capabilities are using the new science that's out there. So we have put forward and started doing the tsunami inundation modeling, state-of-the-art and state-of-the-science tsunami inundation modeling, and turn that into maps. We call these our T-shirt maps because we distill the information down into five sizes of the tsunami you would expect based on whether you're either looking at a remote or just the size of the earthquake, because the earthquake size does directly affect the size of the tsunami you would expect. The focus was to get that done because that information needs to be out there to be used, and we have completed that. We are 100% complete, 363 miles of the coastline modeled and mapped. That's 89 maps, primarily through the funding. We had a little bump in our federal funding from NOAA, and we focused it in a really focused five-year project, and we have done that. That is a tremendous accomplishment, and I really want to give kudos to the Dogami team for completing this and for OEM for being such a good partner in this. We'd like to revamp the program and our key performance measure to focus on applied science for preparedness and resilience. That's really the next step, taking this information and applying it in planning and emergency preparedness. One of the direct offshoots from our modeling was to develop tsunami evacuation maps. We did this in cooperation with local emergency planners and the local advisory teams, and we have 100% complete on that. 45 community maps have been released. You've likely seen them if you go anywhere on the coast. They're stuck up on the sides of walls. They're made available on our website. There's several other websites you can get them and download them. They're an interactive map app, so you should have that on your smartphone. We'd like to retire this at this point because we're not planning to do big changes in these. We will continue to update the evacuation maps as roads and routes change, but that we will refocus on our what we are going to be doing for applied science for tsunamis. We do have coastal erosion work that we've been doing over the years. Coastal erosion mapping is looking at change of the coast, of which there's considerable change that goes on just in the normal everyday change of having a very dynamic coastline, but also in the fact that we have ongoing increase in storms over the last years, and also as we start seeing sea level rise. This is stalled, this particular key performance measure in the work. The performance measure is stalled because we're continuing to do work, but what we are tracking is not what we have been focusing on working on the last few years. And so now that we have the new LIDAR and that we can really, we also maintain a monitoring network for coastal change so that we can go back and reoccupy monuments up and down the coasts and measure what the change in the coastline is over time. We don't have a way to measure that outcome because it's not part of the key performance measure. But it's crucial information that's used by everyone from park and recreation to emergency planners and management. We also have been asked to go back and do revisions of some of our areas where we have done work on coastal erosion, and we don't have a way to capture revisions either. What the key performance measure is only really to capture new stuff, not when you do updates. So we'd like to change to reflect progress in monitoring and documenting change on the coast. Now, when we have something like a storm occur, what you usually end up with is a cascade of hazards. It's not just that you have coastal erosion with storm waves that it frequently will saturate in, and you'll have landslides and debris flows, flooding. We also look at multi-hazards. So that is stacking one hazard on top of another. So you really are not looking at one thing, one issue, but what is it when you're looking at a variety of hazards that are happening, usually caused by the same incident or the same process. We've rolled that into a key performance measure 12. It's our hazard preparedness. This is also the only way that we can measure the work we do, both with LIDAR data collection and with the flood mapping program we have. We presently are a technical cooperating partner with FEMA for flood map updates. This is a list. This shows where we have been working, the current working. This is where we're upcoming. This is where some of them have been completed. We have this. We work with the Department of Land Conservation as well because they administer the FIRM, the flood insurance rate program for FEMA for the state. The reason we do this is, and we have a policy option package associated with our flood hazard mitigation program, is again so we can more comprehensively inventory, map exposure to, and perform risk analyses of river and coastal flooding hazards. Again, right now, we're waiting to see what FEMA thinks is the important parts of the state, but the state really doesn't have much of a way in on that. Why we do this is, again, it's much of the reason because we have the LIDAR data, this very well-focused, accurate elevation data, is that it makes a big difference if you're a person that's concerned about whether or not you're in or out of a flood area. And the flood models are determined by FEMA. If they're put on these low-quality topo maps, which may have 40-foot contours and nothing, we've all seen topographic maps. We've probably all used them. They're 19th century state-of-the-art, but we're now in the 21st century, and so there needs to be these updating, and that's where these very accurate remote sense LIDAR data come from. So this is the same area. This is on the old topographic map, 40-foot contour interval. That means you've got to estimate between 40 feet where that exact flood elevation is, and that doesn't always work out. This is what it looks like whenever you're having a 2-foot contour interval. So all those buildings that were in a flood area have now been eliminated from that because the true flood inundation level was 24 feet, but it was not able to estimate accurately where that was. So we work with FEMA to develop these more accurate maps. We make them available so that if people want to come forward and apply for a FEMA letter of map amendment, that means out as shown, that they're out of the flood area, that they can ask for an amendment on their of whether or not they need flood insurance or not. Now, truth is, for all the ones that are out, there's going to be others that end up being in, because it's accurate, and we don't hide that fact either, and that also can be very uncomfortable. But it does help with overall planning. For example, these are flood risk assessments where we can actually inundate a community to the level of what the flood map is, and we can identify the structures by how high they're going to be inundated because we have this accurate elevation data and give an idea of what your damage estimates are. Much more accurate damage estimates than what we can do now, and both for the vulnerabilities. So all of that is rolled into our key performance measure 12. It measures a whole variety of measures the quality of natural hazard mitigation plans to a whole menu of hazards based on how prepared the counties or the communities are. Do they have a FEMA-approved plan? Is the plan online? How much of our data have they used in their risk assessments? So we calculate we're about 59% success rate weighted by county population right now. That's all fine and good, but it is way too complicated of a key performance measure. Every time we have to go in and redo it again, we have to figure out what we did the last time. We would really like to work with DLCD to develop a joint key performance measure that better reflects our progress in turning hazard data into land use planning and development. And we'd like to somehow pull it out so that we could have a better metric of how successful we are at the LIDAR data acquisition program, which all is inferred from all of this but is not directly measured. Just quickly, I want to say hazards can also be resources. And I'm a volcanologist by training, so I'm very keen on all of the volcanoes in the state. We have a lot of them. They can be considered a hazard. They can also be considered, I mean, they are one of our greatest scenic and recreational resources in the state, and they're also the areas of some of our highest capability for geothermal development, because all of those volcanoes have magma, and magma is heat, and so they're also a resource. So now if we look at our MLRR program, we have two ways that we measure here. We measure mine sites inspected annually. And what you see here is a map of quarry and sand and gravel sites across the state. There's approximately 900 permitted sites right now, 62,000 permitted acres, 25,000 disturbed acres. That's just for the surface mining program. This doesn't pull out the geothermal or the oil and gas program. And our very modest chemical process program would have one little dot right about there. As you can see, the concentration of where the sites are is very similar to what we saw for where our priority areas are. They're concentrated where the people are and where the infrastructure is, primarily roads. It is our responsibility to make sure that those permitted areas are operating properly and within the conditions of their operating permit. We do that with a very field-intensive program. We get folks out there on the ground or remote sensing to look at, to see if we can find where the problems are and fix them before we end up into litigation. It is a fee-funded program. All four of the regulatory programs are. We had a fee restructure in 2005 where we added production on top of the annual fee to try to keep, as you know, in commodities, things are very cyclical depending on what the economy is looking like. And so it definitely has tanked not long ago, and we see that very clearly in the production data. But you can't have your fee revenue doing the same thing, which is what we were having happen. And that it's impossible to maintain a program, a regulatory program, if you're having to track your fees based on your production. So we've worked on stabilizing that somewhat, and we have seen over the last few years that we're not seeing the big drops when you have the drops in production. However, both the increases in the amount of money it costs to run a program and the increases that we have had to add in our overhead expenses because of having to backfill behind our general fund is that we have a fee revenue that's less, 17% less than its peak was in 2006 because the productions are down. So the fees right now are not keeping up with the expenses for the program. Senator Devlin?
Yeah. Ms. McConnell, I did want to thank you for actually presenting a zero-based graph. just to remind members that in other committees or in this committee, you will see graphs like this that are not zero-based, where people are trying to demonstrate greater movement than in reality. So the typical way to have done this would have been to basically start this at about maybe production over here at $25 million,
right.
Which would have made it look as if everything had completely gone off the map.
Right.
This is, you'll see a lot of that in various agencies' presentations, and I would encourage you to always look at how the graph is being made. So, but I appreciate that this is zero-based.
Thank you. So this is part of our conversation or discussion about how to get the expenses and the revenues back in line here, and we will talk a little bit more about that. So the mine sites, the way we track our this is mine sites inspected annually. We go for a 50% target each year so that biennially we'll be looking at 100%. And we inspect unique operators. That means there's operators that have more than one site. And so what we do is we try to visit at least one of their sites every other year. We've really improved our tracking of that. We are always in the, I'll show you here. Yeah. So over the last few years, we've been right at or above 50%. So we're keeping right up with that key performance measure. In order to do that, though, we had to look at a few things. We added a GIS analyst to supplement field work and the workload. We made our permit coordinator position permanent. We added another a junior level reclamationist to cover inspections in eastern Oregon. And that's a part of the reason that our expenses have now risen, because we now have a full complement of staff, and just staff in general increases in cost over time. So we're presently analyzing all of our regulation fees and structures to be able to bring forward some suggestions and plans on how to better align the program's expenses with the revenues. We have one other key performance measure for the MLRR, and that's in the reclamation side, because a very important part of what we're doing is making sure that mines that have been retired are properly reclaimed. So we look at prompt reclamation of acres disturbed, again, those 900 sites. Right now we're looking at 7,600 acres have been reclaimed. That's not including voluntary. These are just the ones that meet the requirements of their permit. This gives you a breakout of what they're reclaimed to, what that secondary beneficial use is. We say we're ahead of the target, but frankly, we don't have a say on when someone decides to retire their mine site. And so we can then promptly make sure that they're reclaimed, but by saying we have 7,600 acres, we don't have any control over that. So we'd like to look at other ways of crafting a better measurement for the reclamation side. And we're definitely open to suggestions and ideas. We do have a customer service satisfaction key performance measure. All agencies are required to report on this. And I have to report that we have no data for 2014. And that's because we have been struggling with a way to capture enough information to make it statistically relevant. Just getting a couple of inputs from someone at a meeting is not really statistically relevant. So we are not reporting anything this year, but we have gone forward and put together a surveying tool. In 2015, we'll be assessing customer satisfaction with agency products and services through surveying agency clients during wrap-up of projects, annually surveying permit holders, annually surveying Nature of Northwest customers, and then surveying attendees at public presentations, and annually survey community partners and stakeholders. So we've put it to our science information officer and her team to develop something so we can bring you back something that is a relevant survey of our services. I will tell you that in the past, we've always had high marks, usually in the 90s, and the two that we get the lowest marks on are timeliness and availability of information. And that's frankly because we're juggling a lot of projects and programs at one time with a minimal amount of staff, and it's hard to get the work out on time sometimes. And the availability of information is trying to keep up with getting everything into an interactive web-based program. And that takes investment, and we simply don't have that right now. Our governing board in 2007 adopted a governance key performance measure that they self-assess themselves on every year and report out on that in usually their September governing board meeting. And so this is their latest report out. Sometimes they have additional notes and comments, but this last year they had a clean bill. We have a whole series of goals to put forward in ourselves that are, again, linked back to our strategic framework. I'm not going to go through these in agonizing detail, but I will point out that they are all contingent on how successful we are with maintaining some of that additional policy option package investment that we are requesting, and that is in the governor's recommended budget. Because to be able to continue that investment and do the work, we need the investment in some of the backfill. Same goes for MLRR. We want to maintain that 50% plus mine site inspections, probably by increased use of GIS technology. And then we will be reporting back with some kind of customer satisfaction survey results in our next key performance measure. So I want to talk a little bit about budget trends over time. Got to make sure I'm not overdoing my time here. And just in case, I have to say something about this. These are all cinder cones outside of Bend. Again, it's that volcano thing. I can't help myself. And so there's a nice little cinder cone that has not what we call really breached. Cinder cones tend to pop out like popcorn and build up a little cinder cone. But if they breach, which is what all these guys did, then you get this lava that comes pouring out in a very detailed and mappable location, again, flowing into all the lowest areas. So that's all LIDAR. You can tell everything that you ever wanted to know about the lava out of a cinder cone from these. So let's talk budget. That's a little tougher to talk about than cinder cones. Have a few things I wanted to bring forward here. This one is looking at our non-LIDAR revenue over the last decade. And so you're seeing non-LIDAR other fund is the blue, general fund is the red, and federal fund is the green, and then that shows you what the total. So that's really looking at what our total biennial budget looks like, sans the LIDAR investment, which there's quite a bit of that money goes right straight out into to the vendor and to the processor. So visually, the story is here. We have very, very variable funding. Our general fund has continued to decrease over time. And even if it looks like it's not decreasing, if it's not increasing, it's decreasing. Because if you have a straight line budget, your expenses are always going up. We have backfilled and managed to not lose crucial staff in our programs by continually backfilling into other fund and into the federal fund. And we've been quite successful. We've built our federal fund up. We knew that wasn't going to last for a couple of reasons. Part of that was some slugs of money that came through with the stimulus package. And part of it is, frankly, the federal agencies are where the state agencies were about 10 years ago. They are looking at cuts. They're tending to cut their cooperative partnerships and keep their in-house staff. That maybe is not such a good idea, but it's a management decision that is frequently made. So we're seeing a pretty big decrease in what we're seeing as available federal funds for many of our cooperative projects. And we don't see that that's going to change a lot over time. Other funds, again, most of this is coming from cities and counties and other state agencies and where we can find. And again, we're seeing a decrease in that. So it's very variable. It's hard for us to look into a crystal ball 2 years out when we make a revenue forecast. We don't have dedicated other fund or federal fund. We're competing or dealing with cooperative partnerships, so we can squint and have a pretty good idea, but it's really hard. We're very conservative. Both DASBAM and LFO keeps us conservative when we're looking at our revenue forecasts, but sometimes you just don't hit it, and we really, really missed the mark on the federal forecast this time around. We also have a lot of variability when our funds come in through the biennium. Again, they're not dedicated, so we're only getting it when we enter into a project or a contract and when we complete that up. And so what you can see, as in here, from September of 2013 through December of 2014, huge variability on what we're bringing in for invoicing and cash flow. That means we have to fall back and spend general fund to be able to backfill so that we can make payroll, so that we can pay for everything that we have paid for. We're like a small business, like the revenue side of a small business in a government box. Therefore, I don't have a line of credit that I can go out. If you want to think of general fund as a line of credit, but it's quite limited. So we can't make a profit. We can't change what the amount is. And we really are limited on where we can go with indirect, which is what we pay for a lot of our administrative or indirect off of our projects. If we get too high on that, then we're not going to be competitive anymore. We're going to be spending too much money on our indirect and not being able to. Many of these programs that we apply to have ceilings or caps or limitations on how much money you can apply for. It'd be great if we could use time and materials for everything that we did, but we can't. We're very limited to a strict budget that you are submitting ahead of time and that you're trying to stay within that budget and develop the product that you've promised someone that you're going to develop. So this type of variability is very difficult to operate an agency or a business. We look at it as unsustainable going into the future, and I say that not in a negative. It's just that our foundational structure is not sound enough right now. We've had a great opportunity to be this enterprise project based. I think we've done a great job. I've shown you evidence of the type of product that we have put forward and that is used daily by our partners. But we really have to look at a way of being able to cover the cost of having an agency and the administrative part of that. I just want to point out some of the things that we end up, and I'm not particularly proud of everything that I'm going to point out up here to you, but this is the reality of business right now. What we're saying in our general fund expenditures estimate will be for this biennium. We have indirect on general fund personal services. That's about 17%. So right now we are not collecting indirect on personal services when they are being paid through a general fund. And you would be. I mean, that's what you should be, but we're not. And so we are not collecting as much as we could. The mineral land regulation and reclamation has a cost overrun, both in their indirects. They have not, those fee bases are not keeping up with what the indirects that program should be paying to the agency. And that's starting to be a significant number now. So that's having to be backfilled with general fund. We need match for a whole variety, particularly of the federal programs. Some of them are written in law, you must have match. It could be up to 50%. They're good programs. They're ones that drive the basic work that we do. But we're finding that you're expected to come up with match more and more, which basically says the state has some interest, some skin in the game of whatever that project or program is. We have project overruns. A lot of that is because, again, we enter into these competitive contracts or projects. We have to put forward a budget based on our best estimate of what it's going to take to be able to produce that product. We don't do time and materials. We do a lot of things that are cutting edge. We do things that, for example, Ian, our chief scientist, was telling me on the way down, for a landslide project, if we estimate that we're what it's going to cost to do a landslide inventory for someone based on the real extent of what they're asking us for, we make our cost estimate of how much it's going to take our experts to do that interpretation and mapping. You have to pick a number. You have no idea how many landslides you're going to find. The more landslides that you find, the more work it is to complete the inventory mapping and the interpretation. We could go with the maximum amount, but then you're generally not able to find the funds, the person that's interested. So we pick a number, say 50 or 75, and if it's much higher than that, it ends up costing us more money that we had no way to really estimate at the beginning of the project. So we end up with cost overruns. And then we have non-project, non-indirect personal services. And this was what I was mentioning before. If we have, we try to keep our principal investigators and our technical folks 100% on projects, but that doesn't always happen. And if you look back, let's see. On this, you can imagine there weren't a lot of projects occurring right then. You don't want to lay off all of your subject matter experts and try to then rehire in a couple of months. That's not realistic to keep the kind of expertise that we need. So you have to have a way to bridge those, and that means putting them on general fund projects put together so that we can bridge over before you get the next project in. Our Nature of the Northwest is our information center, and it is a retail outlet, but it generally, again, we can't make a profit on what we sell, so we do end up with a bit of a cost overrun there. Now, having said all of that, we have very little overlap. We're not doing things that other agencies are doing. We coordinate with other agencies. Here's a whole list: OEM, DLCD, ODOT, DEQ, and OGAMI. We have an intergovernmental agreement with them to administer their stormwater permits at mine sites. That saves money for both agencies. DSL, OWRD, I mean, that's just a small list. We work with parks at times. So we're not out there all doing the same thing. We're coordinating and cooperating amongst the agencies so that we are being the most effective and efficient that we can. That takes a lot of work from all the agencies, though, to keep that coordination going. We've looked at efficiencies and cost containment, again, with our collaborative efforts, leveraging expertise and funds from other agencies. We outsource activities that require job specialization. For example, we don't have internal IT. We use an IT consultant, and we constantly look at, is that actually cheaper? And yes, it is, than having staff in-house. We use the DAS Enterprise Human Resource Client Services for human resource. We don't have that particular position. We keep ourselves as lean as we can. We've closed and consolidated field offices. We have minimized our outreach efforts. We hold vacancy savings. We let project staff go, particularly our at-will limited duration staff, when those projects are finished, so that we're not keeping additional staff on hand. We've fund shifted. The thing right now is going from general fund to indirect cost recovery means that indirect creeps up every time we go in to negotiate a new, and we negotiate with the Department of Interior for our annual indirect cost. That sets what we're supposed to be charging for an indirect for the next year. We're seeing it creep up. We have real concerns this time around that it may not just creep but take a leap. And so that we'll be able to cover our administrative costs. That's going to be really difficult for us to manage, to be able to bring in project work. So we have been directed to develop a plan for sustainable success of the agency from the governor's office. We are very supportive of those efforts. We think that it's a good idea to have the conversation. We're looking for outside eyes. We think that's a great idea. It's in the governor's budget as a one-year budget with a task to report back in 1 year with a plan or recommendation. We look at the opportunity to explore new models. We'll be preparing a plan to stabilize revenue with lots of input from outside and stakeholders. Again, we really don't think we can solve this internally. We've been working on it for years. And the planning has already, I'll just say briefly, the planning has already been initiated by the governor's Natural Resource Office in that the governor's Natural Resource Office is putting together a small working group to kind of develop the charter and time frame. So why wait till the very end? Let's start having those conversations now. And with that, I just wanted to take this opportunity to personally thank everyone in the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. Don't want to cry. It's hard. I've been with the agency for 16 years, and it's a great, great agency. Please find a way to continue the work that they do. It is vital for the state. We're one of the best geologic surveys out there, and I know you can do it. It's just been a great time, and I can't thank everybody there enough. And I want to thank the state of Oregon for having faith in me over the last 11 years to sit up here and make these presentations and to have good policy discussions. It's been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Questions for Ms. McConnell? Okay, I have a few, actually.
Okay.
I'll give you a few moments.
Sorry, folks.
First of all, maybe I should explain. I almost feel like I'm back on public safety last year because I get into the position of I have to explain why the co-chairs have done what they have done. So I wouldn't normally have to do that. Ms. McConnell and later Mr. Miller from the Department of Administrative Services, they have to support the governor's recommended budget.
Yes, sir.
That's the normal process here for those of you that haven't been in these committees before. They will obviously have to answer any questions that the legislature has. So just because they have to support the governor's recommended budget doesn't mean that we have to support the governor's recommended budget. The co-chairs last session, along with the committee, went along with the governor's proposal to give two agencies one-year budgets. One was the Department of Housing, the other was the State Library. I think in some ways the Department of Housing was justified, the State Library was not. We've resolved the issues with housing. Housing is back in place. It's sort of redefined its mission somewhat. The State Library is in somewhat of still a quagmire, even though we restored their second year of their budget. In the short session. The executive branch has walked away from the issues around the State Library, even though they proposed this the first time. So we are still trying to resolve those issues, and hopefully they'll be resolved this issue. The problem with giving a state agency a one-year budget is it looks good to the outside world, and maybe it's a good PR thing, but the reality is it's not very good internally for the morale of staff. It's not very good for recruiting staff as you have replacements. And in this particular case, since this agency is actually largely funded, not entirely, but a large portion comes from what I would refer to as enterprise revenue, where it's hard to go out and solicit additional enterprise revenue when people think that you are going away. Now, they're not going away, or the function isn't going away, but all those things tell us that probably we should give them a two-year budget, and also that we have a 4.5+ months left in this session, so in 4.5 months we should be able to make some progress on where the agency should go. The only thing else I wanted to say was that I wanted to thank you for the this seems like a small thing to some people, but your organizational charts are amongst the most readable that I have ever seen. And they sort of clearly identify your policy option packages and members as you go through other agencies and other agencies outside of natural resources. I think you will see some charts that actually are 20% as understandable as this chart. One of the questions I do have is, have you given any thought to what the sort of base level funding would be necessary to, in a sense, smooth out the issue, so it isn't always a boom to bust kind of thing? I mean, one of the large agencies we have, DCBS, it reacts to the economy, but its needs for services react to the economy also. It's driven by, like, in building codes and things like that. When the economy is down, there's not as much things happening as relative to building codes. It's sort of natural. It contracts somewhat. But in terms of the mission of a department like yours, it doesn't really, it's not really tied to the economy. Right. Has anybody given any idea to what sort of a baseline you would need?
Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Rayfield, and committee members, we have not done a good detailed look at, you know, how to do that. What we have been doing are these piecemeal, again, asking for small investments for backfilling into some of these programs, and I think that's a great idea, but I don't have a number or a percentage for you at this moment. But it certainly should be something that's in this whole planning discussion, is what would it take in the different scenarios.
Okay. Any additional questions from the committee? Yes, Senator Hansel.
Vicki, I want to thank you for your service. I think everybody here does. I've not worked directly with you, but I have worked a long time with your chairman of your board, since he's serving with Tulloch County. I think I know the answer to this question, but I'm just curious. Do you have any involvement with suction dredge mining as a part of the mining operation?
Co-chairs and Senator Hansel and staff, not directly with suction dredge. That is regulated by the Department of State Lands, and in some parts of it by the Department of Environmental Quality. Now, we do have oversight of placer mining that occurs on the floodplains outside of the beds and the banks of the waters. And suction dredge is a subset of overall placer mining. So that's more than you wanted to know, but
that's
I couldn't
helpful.
Resist to give you the whole thing. So the direct suction dredge that has been discussed is not in our purview, no.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. Vicki, I want to echo the comments of gratitude to you and your agency. Dagami, I think, is one of the most highly regarded of the natural resource agencies, and your leadership has been great. you showed a chart in which you talked about the partnerships between Dagami and other natural resource agencies. And I'm wondering to what extent Dagami partners with local government on, providing information on natural hazards, et cetera. You know, we have a bill this session we're looking at in terms of kind of ramping up planning, resiliency planning for natural hazards. And a lot of the decisions for that will be made at the local level, counties, cities, mm-hmm. et cetera. And so does DAGAMI contract with local government, or does it just provide information? How does that relationship work?
Co-chairs and Senator Dimbro and committee members, that's a great question. And I was not complete in not putting local government up there because they are a very important part of our partnerships, both looking at land use issues and hazard issues. It's pretty much an issue by issue, city or county. So again, this not able to do it comprehensive. For example, Clackamas County had a lot of effect from the 2007 storms. Sandy River flooded. They had a lot of debris flows. They had a disaster declaration. So there was some money that came from FEMA through Office of Emergency Management to them for doing post-disaster work. And part of what they did was come to us and say, okay, we want a landslide inventory and susceptibility study done for our county because we know that we have big issues with debris flows and landslides here. And so that's the type of partnerships that we work with all the time. It could be with that. It could be with the coastal communities or the counties. So it's kind of reactive based on some issue that's come up. We have a very good working relationship with nearly all the counties and cities. But that takes a lot of that front-end investment and also that back-end investment. So, for example, we developed a landslide inventory map for Clackamas County susceptibility. We then participated in and actually conducted several workshops to invite planners and emergency managers and your first responders and everyone that may be interested in those data from the cities and counties. So we do a technology transfer. That's not recoverable in the way that we do our project work. So that's something that we feel is very important to do, because why produce this information if it's not being properly incorporated? DLCD is a big partner of ours in looking at helping them to help communities to look at how to build into their model ordinances the use of our hazard maps. Absolutely.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. McConnell.
All right. Thank you.
I'd like to now, instead of going to Mr. Miller with the Department of Administrative Services, I'd like to see if Commissioner Givens would like to address the committee, give you the opportunity. Because I understand you've driven quite a ways to be here, and I don't know if you can be here tomorrow. So.
Thank you. Co-Chair Devlin and Co-Chair Rayfield, I'm Umatilla for the record. Umatilla County Commissioner Larry Givens, also the chair of the DAGAMI Governing Board. Thank you for this opportunity to address this group. I do want to go on record as on behalf of the board, Governing Board for DAGAMI, thanking Director McConnell. She has done a fantastic job. We have really appreciated her leadership with the department and the staff. They have done a terrific job. When I became a member of the DAGAMI board, I have to say every time I sit on a board or a committee, I take that extremely seriously. And under my watch as a member of the board and as a chair of the governing board, I would truly hate to see DAGAMI compromised in any way. The service they do for the state and for the citizens of the state of Oregon is absolutely crucial. And I would encourage this committee and those that are involved to give DAGAMI all the support, and in the future, as we're looking into the budget in the year, 2 years ahead, realizing we are strapped as a state for funding. Every agency and every group in the state wants some type of funding from state resources. It tends to be that way at the county level also. But I would certainly encourage full support of DAGAMI, not only for a two-year stability, but also to increase some stability from general fund. Staff and what's happened in the last few months with DAGAMI, there's been some events that have really left things kind of in turmoil to some degree. I'm sure most of you heard the news accounts of what have taken place. But again, I would really encourage a strong support. I think of what happened up in Washington, it also, I don't want to see an issue like that happen in the state of Oregon. And I want our citizens to be fully prepared and have the data at hand to know how to react and know what to plan for. With that, I won't take any more time. Again, I would say thank you very, very much, and wanted to go on the record thanking Director McConnell for all that she has done. Thank you.
Any questions for Commissioner Givens? Thank you very much for being here today. Colleagues, given the time, and Mr. Miller, you'll be able to come back tomorrow, correctly? My understanding is Mr. Miller will be back tomorrow, Mr. Whitman will come again tomorrow, and you'll have a public hearing tomorrow. I do not know how many people will testify. Will the gentleman that commonly comes in past years, does he come back?
Well, I don't think he will be here this time. We will have a couple of folks that do come in. I expect that. Mr. Engstrom from OCAPA has indicated, and I know there may be one or two other folks that want to give public testimony.
And with that, we are adjourned for today, and if there's no other business, and Representative Clem was actually excused for the meeting.
I just got